up into that, and that could be an issue. And he said, your dad is perfect. You got to worry about your dad. You know what I mean? He was like, we'll see. But after, I think 3 years, my dad and me changed, you know, and he would never tell me, but he was proud of me. When I asked Leslie to marry me, I surprised her. And all my old friends and some of my new AA friends were at this restaurant where I was going to propose. And so they were in the back room waiting for us to get there. And although he would never say it to my face, all my friends were saying the things or telling me the things that my dad told me or saying about me. And it's the things I've always wanted to hear, you know. And now I know where that came from. And you know, that's one of the reasons I'm so grateful. When my dad's cancer became terminal and he was going into hospice, I still felt like there was something left on the plate, something that I hadn't done, something that I wanted to tie up. And so I asked my sponsor and we came up with a plan, and it was an amazing plan. And I asked Leslie if it would be okay if I did it. And she said, yes. So what I would do is I would work during the day like regular. And then I would go to the hospice and I would sleep beside his bed every night on the floor. And my sponsor was big on, you can't thank somebody enough. And so what we came up with, the formula was every morning when we wake up, I'd wake my dad up and I go, good morning, Dad. And I go, I just want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me. You know, the things that we take for granted, like teaching me how to fish, teaching me how to shoot, teaching me how to throw a ball, campouts, all those little things that we just think, I guess parents are just supposed to do. I didn't realize the sacrifices that they did to do those things. And I wanted them to know how much they meant to me. So I would just go through a little list. And then when I would get done with my list, I would tell him, and I grab him by his hands and I go, Dad, if I could have ever asked for a better dad than you, I couldn't have got one. And I'm so proud of you. You're my father, you know? And my dad was kind of like a John Wayne type guy. He's, you know, no affection, no I love you, no nothing like that. Today I know that you can't give away something you don't have. And he never got it. So he didn't know how to do that. So he would just be like, oh, shut up, you know, blah, blah, blah. He was still there. And the cancer was in the brain, and so it moved really quickly. And he got to where he couldn't talk or anything like that. And he was just in the bed. And so at the end, I would wake up, and I would take his hand, and I would say, good morning, Dad. You know, and I would say, I want to thank you. You know, thank you for the cookhouse. Thank you for the grilling. Thank you for taking me fishing. You know, thank you for the presents and the birthdays. Thank you for everything that you did for me, you know. And I tell him, and Dad, if I could have asked for a better father, I couldn't have got one better than you, you know. And I love you. Now I don't know what was going on in my dad's mind as that process was unfolding. I don't know what he was thinking. But what I like to think is that when he died, he knew that I was proud that he was my father, you know? And I think that's a gift. And I don't have a ghost, you know? I don't have a ghost. And I know people that do. And I got that. I got that in AA. And when my mom, you know, my mom's at a, she's at a place now, and she doesn't know who we are. I think she knows, but she can't say it. And I go get her at least once a week, and we go to Dairy Queen, and we have an ice cream date. And it doesn't matter if she don't know who I am. We still smile, and we have ice cream. And she lights up like a Christmas tree, you know. And this was probably back right before the pandemic started, I guess. Because and I went and got her, and I knew that day that she didn't know who I was. And so we went to Dairy Queen, and we got our ice cream, and we just had a good time. And then there's a park in Sylvester, Georgia, and that's where I'm from. And I took her. She used to love to go walk at the park. So I took her by the park, and we walked around the park for a little bit. And then we went back to her room, and we sat on the bed, and she's got baby dolls, and she's got the baby dolls. And I sit there, and I take her, and I rub her arm. Because when I was a little kid, she would sit beside me and she would rub my arm. And no matter what was going on, it just had a soothing effect. And it would just always calm me no matter what. You know, unless we were in church and you did something wrong and then she would pinch you. And there was nothing sweet about that. But she would just rub my arm. And so now I try to do that to her, You know, I don't know if she's scared, but I want her to feel what she used to make me feel. And so one day I'm laying on the bed with her and I'm doing that. And she turns and she looks at me and she said, "Sir, you sure are nice." And I said, "Yes, ma'am. I am now. You know, I am now. And I know where that came from. AA gave me that, you know. AA not only saved my life, it gave me a life. And it's important, you know. Mr. Harry that introduced me, he's one of my heroes. And I've got a lot of heroes in AA. And what heroes in AA are they're just people I believe in. They're people I believe that have found a way of life that is so worth living. And that they've almost grasped new soul. And the world makes sense to them. And they give me hope and they give me inspiration that if I follow this path that I can have what I see in them. And that means the world to me because I refuse to just settle for a mundane life back then. And I refuse to now. And it means a lot for me to have him here today. I wish there was a reason why I ended up being what I am. I don't have one. I grew up now looking back in a household of love, you know. I have one brother. We grew up farming, dairy farming. We had breakfast every morning. The only thing is they're a group. Those three are a group, and I'm not part of it, even though I'm sitting at the same table. You know, I could go into anybody's house. My favorite house is my grandma's. In my grandma's house, she had a old refrigerator, and there's two pull-out drawers. And there's a little space about that far up under it, and she would put this whole thing of Reese's cups. And those Reese's cups would get so cold, man, and you would come in there, and you better not touch those cups because those were just for the grandkids. And we could go in there and get the cups out, and you take that cup, and I just eat the edges all around it, you know what I mean? And then just bite the perfect mixture of chocolate and peanut butter. And then she kept IBC cream sodas, man, and you take that IBC cream soda, and you chase down that Reese's cup, and it's so good, I swear you just want to fall on the ground and just roll around. It's, oh, my God, you know? And every house was that way. Every place that I went to on that farm, all my dad's brothers and sisters lived on that farm. And I was welcome everywhere. And it's crazy that the one time I was maybe one of the favorite nephews would become somebody that they had to change the locks against, you know, and call the cops home. But the main thing, I guess, is that there was just something different in me. And I heard it when I got here that something is missing. I don't feel like you look, and I'm afraid that you'll notice that. And if you were to line us all up, you're going to see that something is missing from me and something is wrong, and I'll be outcast. And so I become an actor at a young age of trying to appear like I'm okay when I'm not okay. And I found my first escape. My first escape was not drinking or anything. It was sports. And I was a little kid, but for some reason, when I got onto a basketball court or a tennis court or a football, any type of field, I felt okay. I felt like I belonged with y'all. Sports came easy to me. But as soon as I walked back off, I was right back there to disconnected, you know. And I tell people, as long as I could dream, I never had a problem. And I know that because early on, like, I knew I wanted to be somebody, you know, and I remember my first drink, and my first drink was nothing. I was probably 8 or 9 years old, and I'd come out from playing, and I'd been out there saving the world because that's what you do at that age. And my mom was the perfect mom, and so when I came in, she had a glass of tea sitting for the world saver out there just playing so hard, you know. And so I run in, and I grab the tea, and I slam the tea, and it's the worst tea I've ever had in my life. I mean, it burnt. I don't understand why anybody would want that tea. Later, I found out that was my dad's drink. And when my dad got home, he had two drinks a night, one before his shower and then one before we ate. And he put it in a koozie, and he hadn't put it in the koozie yet. I know the koozie you didn't touch. And I remember thinking, who would want to drink something like that? You know what I mean? That's terrible. Now, later on, we say we love the way it tastes, right? And that's a lie because your taste buds are just burnt off. You know, you can't taste anything anymore. And so that I know that, but it didn't change anything because that I didn't need. I still, even at that moment when I didn't feel quite right, I thought every next moment I was going to find what I was looking for. You know what I mean? Like it was going to be next year was going to be okay. Next year I'd feel like y'all look. When I accomplished this, I'd feel like y'all would look. So there wasn't no need to worry. as I got a little older, things started changing. You know, those feelings grow. And I'm sure everybody goes through that. But for, I think, the alcoholic or the addict, it's intensified. And where it says, like, we're extreme examples of selfishness, I think that goes into that area also. And I felt that more than other people. And I had an older brother. And if any of y'all ever have like an older brother or older siblings, they're like the coolest people in the world. You know what I mean? Like, all I wanted to do was be like my older brother. And when you're a younger brother, the only thing that they don't want around is you, right? And so I'm already a young kid. I'm small for my age. And the people I really want to hang out with don't want me to hang out with them. And the feeling intensified, you know? And one night, my brother was having a party. And I think they were probably 16, which makes me probably around 13. And they were having it on the farm. They were doing a bonfire camp out, and they were having their girlfriends over. And when you're 12 and 13 years old and your brother's 16, all his friends are 17 and 18, every girl that they date is something that you dream about, you know? Every one of them is a Jennifer Aniston or a Halle Berry, and they are goddesses walking among the earth, you know? And I wanted to be out there so bad. And this night my brother asked my parents, could I go out there? Now, I think the reason he asked, could I go out there, was because they were having a keg and they were having a lot of drinking. And I think they thought that we've got Darren out there, mom and dad won't be worried. You know what I mean? Like, you got a little brother out there. They can't do nothing stupid. They got Darren out there, for God's sake. Right. And I do not care why I'm invited out there. I am just glad that I am invited out there. You know, and I was there. And that's when the drink happened that would alter the course of my life, you know. And my brother's best friend, Tommy, gave it to me. And it was a 6-pack of Michelob Light, which is crazy. And I don't remember being sick. I don't remember anything bad. But what I do remember is a kid that's never felt a part of always felt different. Like he didn't belong, but he wanted to so bad. For the first time in his life, he did, you know. I felt like I belonged with them. I felt like they were lucky I was there. That's how much the change happened, you know. And I didn't realize then that that moment was going to set me on a course for not only self-destruction, but, you know, for everybody that's ever cared about me. And I think that's where the obsession happens. You know, I know I'm an alcoholic. Two reasons. One, when I start drinking, I can't control it. And the other one is when I stop drinking, I can't not think about it. And they call it a physical allergy and a mental obsession. And I think that's where that mental obsession formed right then. And I think everybody has a moment in their life where theirs did. And I don't think our mind is trying to kill us. I think it's just like from that moment on, when things were bad, it goes, remember that message? Remember what it did for that little kid that never felt okay? Send that message. But now I don't realize that a 6-pack ain't going to do it. And it don't know that I can't stop once I start. And it's just trying to buy some time so I can get a real solution. You know what I mean? But why do I need a real solution when I got a solution? And that was it. You know, that was it. I didn't really... I mean, we drank on the weekends. I mean, starting from probably when I was 14 and then to every weekend in high school. But once again, I still had dreams. I was still going to be somebody and I could control it. And, you know, that was going to change. I was a good sports player. I ended up being recruited in high school. And I was real excited, you know. The only bad thing is I love basketball. And why a little short white kid wants to play in the NBA one day, that was my whole goal, you know what I mean, is beyond me. I didn't have another plan, which was bad somewhere on somebody's fault. I mean, I know mine, but we might have should have come up with another plan, you know. But I remember when I was a little kid, I remember being in school. My brother was real smart. And I remember when the first time we were doing the multiplication tables, and there were people in my class that already knew the answers to the questions the teacher was asking. And I didn't. Now, I didn't know that their parents had spent time with them and were teaching them. That's why they knew. I thought that I was dumb. And so right then I knew that I would never do good in school. I had to figure out a way to I had arrived to fame and fortune, and it would have to be through sports since that came easy to me. And I was really excited, but I wanted to play at Kentucky. There was Coach Pitino there at the time, and that was my dream. And of course, Coach Pitino didn't share the same dream, probably never even heard of me or anything. And, you know, where I had these dreams of playing big schools didn't happen, and the only offers I got were junior colleges and NAIA schools. And it's like if you ever can see the writing on the wall, you know what I mean? Like, you don't want to believe it, but you can already see some of the writing that this ain't working out the way you were hoping it would. And that was it. You know, I started seeing it and I started doubting myself. I got had a two sport scholarship to a small college. I played basketball and tennis. And when you got there, it's work. Practices are hard. It's like a business. Players are good. Basically what happened is I went from being a big fish in a small pond to a tiny fish in a big pond. And where when I was little, you know, I worked so hard to get good. Now I'm good and I think I've accomplished something and I don't want to start back over. And he's going to redshirt me. He wanted me on a weight program. And I wasn't going to play my freshman year. And that was just, how could you come off of what I just did and do that? And it was devastating to me. Devastating to me. And I tell everybody I just quit because I didn't want to play anymore. And that's a lie. The reason I quit, if I'm really honest about it, was for the first time, and I guess you would say my adult life, I was afraid that I wasn't good enough. And if you ever, I don't care what it is, if you ever open the door, crack it for fear, and it comes through, you'll never shut the door. You'll never shut the door. And that was it. You know, I remember the day I quit basketball. I walked into Coach Duhon's office and told him that I was quitting. And he said, Darren, I think you're making a decision you're going to regret for the rest of your life. And I told him that he was wrong, that I was number two seed on the tennis team and that I was popular at college. And I would be fine. And I walked out of his office and he was right. I was never the same. I died that day because all my self-worth, all my self-esteem came from that sport. And I was a shadow of a man, person when I walked out of there. And that was it for me. You know, I used to be anti-drug and I didn't care anything anymore. I didn't have a dream anymore. I didn't have anything, you know. My parents sent me to live with my brother who's at school at Georgia. If you're a blossoming alcoholic, maybe Georgia isn't the best place to send somebody. I ended up learning a lot more things and damage was done. I somehow came back. I fell out of college. That's when they sent me up there. I came back and I graduated, but it was over. You know, as a person, I am done. I got a job after I graduated in Atlanta. And I tell everybody I was at like the third floor of a building in Alpharetta, nothing but future ahead. And I worked my way down from there. From that moment, I graduated college in 1998. I would only work for a company no more than a year. And by then they found out what I was and they didn't want me anymore, you know. And by 2008, I'm unemployable, unemployable. I guess I really started having problems with drinking probably as soon as I quit the basketball team. I got a DUI my freshman year, but had gotten kind of out of it. And then I got a second DUI my sophomore year, which is when I failed out. And then I guess in 2007, in 2008, in that period of time, I got three DUIs in a row and I had seven total. And there was a judge in Albany. My mom was a probate judge. And so she knew people and my brother had helped keep me out of trouble. And there's a judge here in Albany. He said, Mr. Hall, it looks like somebody's been taking care of you far too long. And that's just gonna stop. And it did, you know. I ended up doing a little over a year in three county jails, and any semblance of a life that I dreamed of having was gone. I was worthless, and I knew it. I could try to act like I was okay, and I wasn't. The good news is I met a girl in jail At Lee County is a really small jail, and so like I was the only trustee, and so I'm the only guy they saw three times a day. I took their breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you know. And if you let me do that, that makes me extremely good looking, you know, if I'm the only guy they see. And I got my pick of the litter, man. If y'all would have seen her standing on those stairs in that orange jumpsuit, y'all would have been amazed too. It was just like a picture of beauty. And when I got back, man, I had like letters in my laundry bag were just every night was just full, you know. It was just awesome. And her mom and dad were so excited because they got this college graduate that used to be a loan officer is going to save their daughter. And lost person can't save anybody, you know what I mean? And it wasn't good. My parents, they still hate her. I think they think she tried to kill me. She got me to do things that I said I'd never do. And but to me, she's an angel. Because I think if I wouldn't have done some of those things, I think I would have prolonged me from getting here, you know? It brought me down fast. You know, made me into, I heard Mr. Harry say one time, he said that alcohol at one time made him into the person he always wanted to be. And I get that, you know what I mean? But then one day it makes you into the person you never wanted to be. And that's what I became. You know, I became somebody that stole from my mom and dad, from my family. Just pathetic, you know. Had a really great misfortune, I guess you would say. I had a couple events happened back to back to back. You know, Mr. Chuck Chamberlain says you got to have a moment of clarity for this thing to ever happen. And a moment of clarity, he said, was there'll come a day when you can't put anything between you and you, and you see yourself for what you are, what you become, what you're doing. And you, if it's true, it's disgusting to you. You know what I mean? And that's what has to happen. And so mine happened, and there's like really four events that took place. One of them is my best friend was my cousin. And, you know, we said we were never going to get married, never have kids, none of that stuff. There was a group of us that were best friends, and we were going to rock and roll party forever. And they start changing the plan. They start getting married and moving up in companies and doing things, having kids. And I'm sticking to the original plan. I never waver. You know what I mean? I'm sticking to it. And Jim was one of those guys. He ended up having five kids, and, you know, they were just my favorite things in the world. But I had to be cool Uncle Darren when I went over there. It means I had to have something to go over there to be who I think I need to be for him. And I remember one day I went to go get him in gym, as he's big, 6'7". And when I walked up to the house, he met me outside of the door, and he was him and Stephanie, and he was crying. And he said, "Darren, we can't let you take these kids no more." He goes, "You can't come to our house no more." He goes, "I don't think you'd hurt them intentionally, but we don't know what you're doing, and we can't risk that anymore. You know, if you ever get better, you come see me." And I remember just being so mad, you know, how could he say this to me? And I don't need y'all. I don't need you. And I did, and it hurt, man. God, it hurt. It hurt. The second thing is my mom. My mom was a probate judge. I grew up in that courthouse. The people in that courthouse have known me since I was a kid. One day I needed something. I needed money. And my mom had already told, my dad told my mom if she gave me any more money, she could pack her stuff and get out of the house. He gave her an ultimatum. And so it was really, really bad. And I called and I pleaded. And I said, "Mama, please, God, this will be the last time ever. Please, just please, please, God, please." And she said, "You can come get the money, but this can never happen again." You know, and I said, "It never will. It never will." And so I got him to take me up there. And it's the middle of summer, July. And I got a short sleeve, long sleeve shirt and cutoffs and flip flops. And I walk in her office, and Miss Carolyn and Miss Ann are sitting there. They have seen me all my life. And when I walk in the door, both of them look like they've seen a ghost. You know, like what I am scared them. And it bothered me so bad that I turned around and I went back to the car and I told Jamie and them I couldn't get it and I needed to get it. My dad was a man's man. He, at one time was a cheer. He loved watching me race things, play things. He watched me win at about everything I've ever done. And they had moved me back in their house to try to keep me alive, I guess. And one night I ran out of everything and I didn't have anything. And I feel like an anxiety attack coming on and I feel my heart racing and I knew I'm fixing and I'm walking around beating the wall, you know, and I go to my dad and I'm like, you know, Dad, please, I didn't have a bottle. I didn't have any magic medicine. I didn't have anything. I was like, Dad, please give me a drink. You know, please give me a drink. Please give me a drink. So he has to go to his liquor cabinet that he had to put a lock on and unlock it. And he gets out a bottle and he puts down a glass and I get the bottle and I'm pouring and shaking and I pour two glasses and then I take the first one and throw it up immediately in the sink. And then if you've ever done it, you take the second one and follow it just straight with it. And it's like, if you've ever been underwater and you're trying to get to the top and you just feel it all running out. And as soon as you break through, it's just like, and you immediately stop shaking and you immediately stop sweating. And I remember just laying down on their tile floor, and tile always feels so good, you know? And I just remember laying down on that tile floor. And when I start to get up, my dad's got this look on his face that I've never seen before. And it's not contempt. It's just, I don't know how you describe it, you know? And my dad looked at me and he said, "What are you?" And I said, "I don't know, Dad." The last thing was my brother. He is I told y'all he's my hero. When I was little, I used to have nightmares. I'd wake up in closets outside in front of the TV. Back then it just had snow going and there was a movie Poltergeist. And it would give me nightmares even more. And I'd go to my brother's room and he would let me stay in his room with him, which is weird because his room is scary. He's a drummer. And so there's like Judas Priest and Van Halen and Iron Maiden posters. And it was dark, it's scary, scary room. He's got a skull with a candle in it and everything like that. But he was my older brother. And anytime I felt bad, I could lay beside him and I feel okay, you know? And I was in really bad shape. It's 2011, and people were scared for my health, I guess you would say. And so I got a message. Me and my brother weren't talking anymore, and I got a message that I could come to his house. And so I went to his house. He got a really, really nice house. And he gave me some food. He gave me a pint of liquor and a couple of beers and a couple of Ambiens. And he said, "I want you to stay here tonight, and I want you to know tomorrow we're going to get you some help. I'm going to get my little brother some help. You're going to be okay." And next thing I know, I come to, and I'm in the truck with my dad, and I got blood all over me. I'm in my boxer shorts. My dad's just hitting me, and I don't understand what happened, and I don't understand what's going on. And my dad ends up telling me that when I get to my brother's house, I walk up to him and face him like a man, like a man. And so when we get to my brother's house, got this long driveway. He's out by the garage and he's just shaking. And if you've ever seen somebody so mad, they're just shaking. And my dad, when we get there, he said, "All right, time to pay the piper." And so I walk up to him and my brother just grabs me, throws me against his wall and tells me that I'm no longer his brother. You know, he said, "If I even ask my mom and dad for one more thing, he's going to kill me." And he wasn't kidding, you know. Now, this is the guy that used to let me stay in his room and have nightmares and did all this too. This is what I drive them to do. And what ended up happening was in the middle of the night, I got up and I guess in a blackout and he leaves his wallet on the counter and I got $500 out of it. I stole his girlfriend's car to go get what I wanted. That night when I got back home to my mom and dad's, I've never felt what I felt that night. You know, I've always used to feel like that maybe there's a chance it could be okay. And it was gone, you know. I used to have these little death fantasies, like when I die, that everybody'd be sad. You know, all the girls would be, "Oh, we loved Aaron." And all the guys were, "He was so cool, man. We just didn't understand you." And all that was gone, you know. I knew something in my heart. I knew that if I'd have never been born, that the world would be a better place. My mom had two miscarriages. If I'd have been one of them, her and daddy would have had a better life. You know, I knew that. I knew that everybody I ever met would have been better if they'd never, ever seen me. Every girl I'd ever dated would have been better if I never kissed her. Every girl, every place I ever worked, if I'd have never clocked in, it would have been a better business. I knew that, man. You know, I knew in my heart. The only thing I didn't want to do is I just didn't want to wake up again. You know, and people would ask me towards the end, "You're not afraid of dying?" And it's not that we're not afraid of dying. It's just I'm more afraid of waking up every day and feeling like I did, you know what I mean? And seeing the world like I do. I'm more afraid of that than I am anything else. And checking out seems like a good possibility, you know? And I wake up, my pistol in the bed, but too scared to pull the trigger. And I just didn't want to live no more, you know? You know, my mom had sent AA people to come see me, and I'd never been real hospitable. Mr. Clyde, Mr. Mike from the Sylvester Group, we'd come over there several times. And this time she sent a preacher of all people. And he came over and he said, they said you used to be a good boy. They said you were a good person. He goes, are you now? And I said, no, sir. And he said, you don't have to live like this anymore if you don't want to. And I wish I could say that I would choose what was going to happen to me, that I would choose to want to be some semblance of maybe what my life is now. But that's not the case. The case, I mean, the truth is, all I wanted was the pain to stop. You know what I mean? I just wanted the pain to stop. And however that came about, I didn't care. I had no idea what was going to happen. You know, I don't know how the hopeless find hope, but I think it starts with a smile. I think it starts with a handshake, and you'll find those at the meetings everywhere. And I just remember watching the people and wondering, is it real, man? Can you live a life and do the things like I've done and ever feel okay again? Is that even a possibility? And I believed in one person. There was one person I believed in at first. And that's all it takes, man. That's all it takes is one person, you know? And just, I kept coming. At first, I wanted to do it by myself. I didn't want to sponsor it. My dad was big. You get yourself into a mess, you get yourself out, and I could figure it out. And I was trying, and I was getting more confused and more confused. And I'm looking at other people, and their lives are getting better, and I'm still fighting everything. And then one night, I just gave up, you know, and I just gave up, and I made a decision that I didn't care if I wanted to be right anymore. I want to see if there's a way to have some semblance of happiness, of contentment, of a way to live this life that doesn't hurt. You know what I mean? And there was a little young kid at the place I was at, and he was talking about recovery, and he said, Darren, what do you have to lose by going all in? And he was only 18, and he was right. And that's what I did. I got a sponsor. And, you know, things just started changing. I wish I could tell you where – like what I did that happened, but I think I heard somebody say one time that they're glad they don't know exactly what happened, you know, what it did, because then they wouldn't do everything. And I remember early on hearing somewhere between one and 12. I hated that, man. I was like, tell me when this is going to happen, you know? And today I know where mine was. Mine was in making amends. Something happened to me, and I hadn't been right the same. The only thing I can tell you is, everything has changed and nothing changed. You know? I see the world. I see the people. I see everybody differently. And in a world that was hard, a world that was pain, now is just, I see promise and possibility. You know, no matter what's going on. And that is absolutely that is amazing to me. Our life today is insane. I'm so busy. I have more fun than I ever have. I don't know. That's the biggest thing that I always try to get across to newcomers, is that this life is fun. It's a life worth living, because if it wasn't, we wouldn't do it. You know, I'm married now. It still blows me away. She's got terrible taste in men, but I don't care. I used to think that my dad paid her. Now me and Derek see all the financials, and I don't think there's anything like that. But I don't care why she's there. She's just there. And we have the most fun. I don't have any kids, but she had three. And so now we have grandbabies. We have two now. But when the first one came around, man, it was just, he won my heart. You know, it got me to see a little taste of maybe what our parents see in us, in the hopes and the dreams that they had for us. And he's my buddy, man. He's my buddy. And, you know, I would have never got to experience that if it wasn't for this. And I think about him a lot in recovery. But I want to always be there for him. I want to be there for Leslie's kids, even if they don't know that, you know. if they ever need me, I want them to know that they can come to things for me that maybe they can't go to their mom and dad. And that I understand, because I've done things and experienced things that give me an unbelievable empathy for almost anything, you know? And probably my favorite thing that's happened in recovery lately wasn't even me. It was probably her. And this was last year. It really started bothering me that, you know, that the grandson, he wouldn't get to see his real granddad. And, you know, when Leslie and Alan, I guess, divorced, you know, she ended up giving him a choice, you know, that either he could continue doing what he was doing or they could be a family. And she thought it was an easy choice, and it was. And I think it was really hurt her, you know, and devastated her. And there was a lot of fear and a lot of fright going on. And when Al-Anon came into her life, man, just the change that has happened has been amazing. And last year when Alan wasn't getting to see the grandbaby, man, it just devastated me. It broke my heart. And I told Leslie about it. And, you know, she ended up talking to her son some. And this is recovery, man. I don't care where it comes from. And she was able to tell him why his dad is the way he is and why he does some of the things that he does. And she was able to help him get an understanding of what makes her his dad into the person he is. And that maybe, you know, that maybe he can't help it sometimes, and he's trying, because I know that's true. I remember being in situations where I wanted to be a part of and I couldn't, and I knew that, you know, but I knew it was me, but I couldn't change. And wow. I think my favorite thing was on Christmas this year, she sent me a picture. And all the picture of was a picture of Alan holding Harrison. And I thought that was probably the most beautiful thing I've got to see lately, you know? And that's recovery, man. That's, I don't care where it comes from. That's recovery, to be able to see somebody we once hated that much differently, to where you can have compassion, empathy, and care, regardless of what's going on. And that's what makes her one of my heroes too. And I don't know where the time goes, but it goes fast. I guess if you feel like no one understands, you're wrong. If you don't think that you deserve a chance at another life, you're mistaken, you know? No matter what brought you to where you are, there's always hope. Where there's breath, there's hope. And it may be AA, it may be Al-Anon Family Group, it doesn't matter. If you start looking, you'll find recovery. And I love Mr. Chuck Chamberlain's definition of sobriety. Sobriety is the ability to live comfortably, peacefully, and joyously within oneself. And that's what we find here. I don't not drink or not use because of consequences. I don't not drink and not use because I don't want the way that I woke up this morning to ever go away. I don't want the way that I lay down tonight to ever go away. I don't want a feeling of purpose and passion, that life has a semblance of making sense, of understanding other people and all the things in it, to ever go away. And I think if I stay connected, if I follow in the footsteps of the people ahead of me, that'll never have to happen, you know? And that's a beautiful thing to me, because I think one of my good friends says that what the opposite of addiction is connection. And to me, that's it, you know? And I found it here, and I hope you will too. I want to read like one little thing, and it's not really AA, but it's AA to me. And this is what it says. It says, for what it's worth, it's never too late or too early to be whoever you want to be. There's no time limit. You can start whenever you want. You can change or you can stay the same. There are no rules to this thing. We can make the best of it or we can make the worst of it. I hope you make the best of it. I hope you see things that startle you. I hope you feel things you've never felt before. I hope you meet people who have a different point of view. I hope you live a life you're proud of. And if you're not, I hope you have the courage to start all over again. Thank you very much for the opportunity to come share with y'all today. It's an honor. I would give anything for my mom to be able to see this. I know she would be proud. If nobody told you they loved you today, I do. My name is Darren Hall. I'm a member of the Albany Central Group. And if I can ever do anything to help you, I hope you'll find me. Thank you.
That was an awesome.